Okay, the section we're dealing with now is freedom through inner renunciation. We just finished The Supreme Science of Knowing God. That's the title of chapter 17 of Swami's book. Chapter 5, verse 1 of the Gita. Arjuna said, O Krishna, you speak of renouncing action, yet at the same time you recommend it. I would like to know for certain which of these two is the better path. 5.2. The Blessed Lord answered, when rightly understood, both action and non-action lead to salvation. Of the two, however, right action is better. 5.3. O mighty armed Arjuna, only that person deserves consideration as a true renunciate who finds freedom from entanglement easy, having no likes or dislikes, and no attachment to duality. 5.4. It is the ignorant, not the wise, who speak of the paths of wisdom, Shankhya, and Yoga as being different from one another. One who is truly established in either receives the benefits of both. 5.5. The state attained through wisdom, Jnana Yoga, the path of discrimination known as Shankhya, is the same as that attained by action, the science of yoga. The two paths lead to one single realization. 5.6. Renunciation, however, O mighty armed Arjuna, is difficult to achieve without God-uniting activity, yoga. By the practice of yoga, the muni, whose mind is absorbed in God, soon attains the perfection of oneness with the Absolute. 5.7. No taint of karmic entanglement remains for him who has been purified by right action and engaged in divine communion, yoga, has dissolved his ego in infinity, has achieved victory over the senses, and has realized himself as one with the self of all. 5.8. He who, in the state of union with God, has cognized the truth fully, I myself do nothing at all, though he sees, hears, touches, smells, tastes, moves about, sleeps, breathes, speaks, excretes, grasps with his hands, opens or closes his eyes. Such a person knows at all times that these are but the senses engaging their sense objects. 5.10. As the lotus leaf is untouched by water, so the yogi who acts without attachment, self-offered to the divine, is not affected by sensory experience, whether gross or subtle. 5.11. For purification of the ego, yogis merely work with the body, mind, discrimination, and sense organs. They are never attached to them. Six, 5.12. The God-united yogi, relinquishing attachment to the fruits of action, attains unshakable inner peace. That person, however, who does not direct his energies upward toward union with God, is ruled by desire. Attached to the fruits of action, he lives in perpetual bondage. Swamiji, you know, uses this commentary, the whole book of the Gita. He sort of has swept into it just many ideas on many subjects. The Gita itself lends itself to being a complete manual of many aspects of the spiritual path. And as I've said to you several times before, he did write this in India, and he also had an Indian audience in mind. And he's speaking to some of the more traditional disputes in the Indian culture about the meaning of the Gita and about aspects of the spiritual path. And one of those aspects has to do with whether or not we're here talking about action, inaction, action, non-action. But what we're really talking about is whether or not you can make real spiritual progress when you're engaged in activity in the world, or whether you have to withdraw from all engagement with the world in order to grow spiritually. And it's a dispute that doesn't arise as much in our culture, because the spirit of renunciation is not very active. And the only models that we have are the Catholic monastic models, and most of those are service-oriented orders. So it's a whole different way of thinking. But in India, you have this whole old reality, really left over from karma, Kali Yuga is really what it is, where in the age of Kali, when matter was so heavy and society was so dense, it was very difficult to be engaged in the world at all and still keep any kind of spiritual life going. Life itself was very difficult, if you think of the plight of women especially, but also of men. There was just, it was so hard. Life itself was so hard that you didn't have much left over. And also society, the level of society was not at all light. And so there was this just sort of need, if you were serious, you just had to repudiate it all. But even in those times, because this was, Krishna wrote this in Kali Yuga descending, he wanted to warn against mistaking form for substance. And that's really what this whole section is all about, which is that you can't just think that if the form of your life looks like you're a renunciate, that you genuinely are. And Master speaks in very non-supportive terms about the great danger of not being, not having responsibilities, not having duties, and merely repudiating one way of life without really having the dynamic energy to embrace another. In other words, you can't simply stop. If you're not working outwardly, you have to be putting out commensurate energy on an inner level. I know when Swami would talk to the renunciate women in the very early years of Ananda when we had a monastery, he said very simply, he said, look how much energy a mother has to put out to take care of a family. He said, if you choose not to have a family, you must put out twice as much energy for the world as you would as if you were a mother. He said, don't think that the path of renunciation is on any level an escape from those responsibilities or an escape from those demands. It's just another way of serving to the exact same level. In our culture, we don't have, especially not now, there's no sense of superiority of the monastic life. In the Indian culture, there's this undercurrent, which is less prevalent now, but it's still in the culture, that to renounce the world is a superior path, because the thought is understood that life is just a dream, that this is just ego involvement, that it's just the wheel of samsara, and that if I can just step off of it, then I must be living in a more advanced state. And Swamiji and Master want to really attack that thought, because that's a very Kali Yuga thought, and it doesn't lead to real transcendence of the ego. I mean, I remember getting caught in this very thought myself. I had been living as a monastic in the Ananda community until 1982, and at that point, the whole monastic situation at Ananda, that round of it just dissolved pretty much, and many of those of us who had lived that lifestyle shifted over and became householders. And David and I got married at that time. And not long afterwards, Swamiji wanted a lot of us to move back to the parcel of land called Ayodhya. We'd had the monasteries at Ayodhya, and when the monasteries dissolved, the whole housing situation there just shifted. But his home was still there. So after time had passed, he started suggesting that some of us just move back to Ayodhya. And in order for David and I to have a place to live there, we would have to build a house. And it was a very interesting experience for me, because David has never had any sense of difference about different realities in the world. And what I mean by that is he has always looked at whatever is in front of him as just the necessity to put out energy. He doesn't think in terms, this is spiritual, that's not spiritual, this is, you know, what a yogi should do, this is what a yogi shouldn't do, this is renunciation, this is involvement in the world. He just, whatever it is, it's just energy, and he just puts out the energy. Where I, especially in that very beginning period, I was sort of moving from being a monastic to a householder, and I had lots of complexes that I didn't really realize I had. And Swami sort of, I can only say, sort of tricked us into building a house. There was a little tiny cabin, and he wanted us to come and live there. This is now the house that's the guest house at Crystal Hermitage. It's right next to Crystal Hermitage, right just next to where Jyotish and Devi live. There was a little humble cabin there. And he suggested, why don't we just live there? And we all lived very humbly. But that place was just too small for both David and me. When we first walked in to look at it, I felt like, the way I described it to Swami later, I felt like his aura just filled up the whole place, and I just was flattened against the wall. I just couldn't imagine how I could live on an everyday basis with no room to breathe. So he said, well, just build a house there. And we had no money to do such a thing. He said, well, you can borrow it, and then you can go out and give classes and pay the money back, which was also a way to get me out of the village and get me on the road. So the whole thing was a big trick. But it all worked, and it all worked out beautifully. But once we decided to build a house, David just started thinking about how to design it, how to make it lovely. You know, his mind immediately just expanded out to the project at hand, and he began to work in a conscientious manner. My mindset, which I didn't, took me a while to sort out, but my mindset actually was, as long as I was poor, I could be certain of being spiritual. But as soon as I engaged in something like building a house and choosing how it should be beautiful and, you know, putting my mind to something like that, it was an enormously threatening experience for me, because my concept of spirituality was strongly based on the form. That's really how it came out. But I didn't know that for a while. So all I thought I'd do is that if we're going to build a house, no, I consciously thought if we're going to build a house, we shouldn't put much energy into building it, and we shouldn't care how it comes out. That was my idea of being spiritual. David sort of put up with that for a while until he finally said in his inimitable fashion, if you're not going to help, at least get out of the way. And that was when I began to sort of stand back and think, because the example that Swamiji set was not that at all. Swamiji has put great care and attention into the places where he lives, into designing them if he built them, or decorating them if he inherits them, and is always concerned with the aesthetics of things and so on. I wasn't living according to his example. I was living according to this divided thought in my mind that monastic is superior to householder, and if I'm going to be a householder, I'll still be a monastic in the middle of being a householder. And when I talked to Swami about it, his answer was very simple. You don't become free of something by doing it badly. Because to do it badly, to not put energy into it, is the wrong kind of inaction, you see? That's where this whole discussion in the Gita is about, which is that many times when we have an aversion to something, when we feel that it is, you know, just many different likes and dislikes of the heart, and yet we're confronted with a duty, that we'll imagine that the spiritual way to respond to this is to not put energy into it, not put out good energy. That's what I really mean. And it happened also, you know, when I wasn't the only one of the monastics who found themselves on the married side of the equation without having planned to be there, essentially, or having anticipated we were going to be there. And there was more than one way in which the monastics tried to pretend that we were still monastics even though we were married. And you know, when Swami got wind of that, he said, look, you can't have it both ways. Once you make a commitment to something, you have to see that commitment all the way through to the end. And this verse of the Gita is really talking about that, that it is not a question of what your life looks like externally. It's a question of what you are doing with it internally. You can be just as ego-involved living in a cave, you know, with nothing but a little bit of rice every day, as you can be living in a palace. And of course, Krishna himself was a king. Arjuna was a king. That whole crowd of great spiritual souls all lived on the worldly power wealth side of the picture. You have other examples like Ramakrishna, who was born into not abject poverty, but extreme simplicity, and always lived. He lived in a temple. He never had anything. He was always utterly indifferent to the things of this world. Anandamoyi Ma also just lived without ever settling in any situation. But Master himself came and bought Mount Washington and made it beautiful and developed Lake Shrine. And so Krishna is really trying to get us to understand that to participate in the world does not in itself bind us to the world. That what binds us to the world is when we become confused about who and what we really are. And this is, and even too much fear of that involvement, somebody was saying to me recently, and it's so obviously true. We think so much about our spiritual development, but the very nature of our spiritual development is not to be thinking about ourselves. That above all things, we have to just let go of that sense of I. I recall at one point when I very first went to Ananda, it was an interesting lesson for me. I started working in the retreat kitchen at the, what was the meditation retreat, was the only retreat we had then. And we were very shorthanded and young and didn't have any other things to do. And I worked, the kitchen served 3 meals a day, 6 days a week. We ostensibly fasted on Guru Day, except it mostly meant that people just snuck into the kitchen and took things out of the refrigerator. but we didn't serve any meals. But on that day, I would go to town and get groceries for the whole week and do laundry, because we had no laundry facilities, and do the personal laundry of a great many people in the community as well. We had this big pickup truck, and I'd just load up and then take a list of everybody's. We had no cars, so everything was very communally oriented, so I would go and fill the truck up and come back. And I did that with one half-time assistant, cooked 3 meals a day, 6 days a week, and shopped on the seventh. It was wonderful. I mean, was not meant to in any way sound like a complaint. It was absolutely so much fun, and I was so busy that I just really completely, well, to the extent that I was able at the time, but I just lost consciousness of myself as a separate entity from the flow of work that was happening. It was really a golden period spiritually, because everything was so new, it was so thrilling. But when I think about that, it's just, there was just this constant flow that had to be taken care of, and there was no need to consider personal reality of the one whose energy was flowing. You just got up, you did what you had to do. I mean, this is where saintliness comes from, through raising a family, through being a parent, through being a creative artist, through being a missionary, all these sorts of things, where there's just so much in front of you to do. But every time the thought crosses your mind, well, what about me in this? Where do I fit in? You know, then immediately all of that flow of energy is constricted down to the one who does it. Swami tells a story about, he said only one time in the history of Ananda did it occur to him to take personal credit. And it was, he was walking in the area where the Ayodhya housing cluster is now, but at that time there was, we didn't live in that area, we all lived sort of down the hills a little bit, we always liked to be out of sight. So he was walking by that road there, by the big gigantic oak, and he could see just a few little, you know, trailers blinking in the distance, and he could hear someone chanting. And the thought crossed his mind, as he put it, this used to just be a dark forest, and now look what is here. And then he said, he thought, and I did this. But as soon as the thought came to him, as he described it, that he had done it, he said it somehow, the whole expansive reality of what he'd been enjoying just constricted all the way down to him. And it was suddenly, it wasn't a divine flow of energy, it was just a little reality created by him. And he, the way he describes it, he said it wasn't only that it was an untrue thought, it was just the fact that it felt so confined. It felt so much more confined than just the joy of experiencing what had happened, that he said with great strength he just repudiated the thought, and he said it's never occurred to him again to take personal credit. Now imagine, I mean, just think how many times every day our thoughts turn to our own reality and our own relationship to a situation. Much later in this chapter, we have that whole section about how the yogi simply uses these elements of the ego in the individual body. He calls it the ego is the unit of reality through which he expresses, you know, that in the early days of spirituality, thinking of those early days at Ananda, so many people had so many sincere but pretentious ways of dealing. There was this one gal who called herself Mushroom. I don't know why. She showed up and lived with us for a while. She called herself Mushroom. And she always referred to herself as this unit of consciousness. You know, instead of just using a simple I pronoun, she just called herself this unit of consciousness. And it was pretentious and not entirely sincere because it drew more attention to this unit of consciousness than the simple use of a pronoun would have. But I've never forgotten it because it also has a certain uplifting charm to it to just be a unit of consciousness. You see how different that is than thinking about I, me, mine? And Swami writes at great length about how the image he uses, which is just so beautiful to contemplate, when a carpenter picks up a hammer and uses the hammer to accomplish something, the carpenter never makes the mistake of thinking he is the hammer. It's just so clear that this tool is separate from me. But the only reason that that's so clear is because he can take it out of his hand and put it aside, and then he carries what he calls himself somewhere else, and the hammer doesn't come with him, right? It's harder for us to get this separation from our bodies because we're always living in it. And even more powerfully, we tend to live at the medulla. The medulla is the point where the ego is centered. It's very interesting to contemplate the relationship between the medulla and the spiritual eye, especially when we're trying, I mean, for the context here, where we're trying to really break this sense of ego. The medulla is the place where the sperm and ovum unite, and the first cell is created, and from the medulla, the little spine is made, the energy goes down the spine. I was looking at Your Developing Embryo book for pregnant mothers, and one of the first little pictures of your developing embryo, it looks like a potato stick. It's just like a little matchstick. It's just this little straight piece of something. I don't remember now if it was an actual photograph or a drawing. Must have been a drawing. But it's like first the sperm and ovum make that one cell, and then the little spine is made. And then once the spine is made and all the chakras are in place, the chakras can do their duty and they can start manifesting the body according to the vibrations and the consciousness that spine has. And it all comes from the medulla. And, you know, a person can die easily if anything interferes with this, because this is the seat of consciousness. But Master describes this as this is the sixth chakra, and it's the positive and negative pole of the chakra. And even the spiritual eye is the reflection of the energy, the way it flows through the medulla, the irda and the pingala. I can never really explain these things well because I don't experience them. So I can say the words, but I can't speak with authority. But the part of it that I can speak about is much more impressions. The reason that we live through our eyes more than any other sense is because our point of view on our own life is the medulla. You know, this is our box seat. We're just settled in at the medulla, and this is what we carry around. I mean, you know, it's sort of fun when you turn like this, you realize this is the point you're looking from, you see, because you're looking out through your eyes. And when we meditate, we're trying to shift the point of view. We're trying to shift in the sixth chakra, we're trying to shift from living in the medulla pole, the negative pole, to the positive pole, which is the spiritual eye. And shift our whole point of view from one of being settled back to being uplifted here. We're sort of, you get in front of the duality, you might even say. Because it's these two eyes, everything is symbolic. You look from the medulla and you look out in a dual way. And so this is the play of dark and light, of shadow and substance, that just is what we're always seeing. And that's why we see ourselves as separate. It's always the movement. But all of our efforts to meditate are to lift our energy and above all to shift our perspective from the individual egoic self to the self united in Christ consciousness. If thine eye be single, thy whole body will be full of light. That's how Jesus put it. And you know, people have no idea what that means. None at all. But it's a very direct statement because the spiritual eye looks somewhat like an eye, you know, with the dark center, the pupil, and so on, and the iris, the white outside of it, the light outside of it. Let's see, now where was I with all of that? So that's why Master said, as much as possible, keep your focus at the spiritual eye, not merely when you're meditating, but all the time. It certainly, I found many times in any difficult situation where you don't quite know what to do or you feel anxious or anything like that, just to move from the medulla to the spiritual eye, all of a sudden a much deeper sense of calmness will come in and great inspiration. And I was talking to someone about counseling people too. You can have a feeling in the heart of what you ought to do, but you always have to lift that up to the spiritual eye, because you can have a good idea from here, but you'll have a better idea from here. It'll balance what you're supposed to be doing. And Master says also, when people die, most of the time the energy has withdrawn, and it reaches the sixth chakra. And because we are in the habit, let me phrase it differently, unless the person is used to meditating and at that point puts out a great deal of inner energy to move the consciousness up to the spiritual eye, what happens in death is you fall back into the medulla. Is that an interesting way to put it? You fall back because the physical energy is over, and if you don't know how to generate energy in a non-physical way, you fall back into the medulla and you remain in ego consciousness, and then you go on to your next birth. But if we're trained to raise our energy powerfully when we get to that point, then we lift it up to the spiritual eye and go through. When my friend Paula died, our friend Paula, who died consciously, surrounded by many friends whom she had drawn together to help her die, very unusual circumstance. In the last half hour, when she had pulled the supplemental oxygen off, and it was 4 a.m. and had woken up the 2 or 3 dozen people who'd been hanging around with her for 3 days and announced that now was the time, she needed everybody. She didn't say, "I'm about to die." She just said, "Everybody come in here right now." And we all came in there right now. And she just got very, very still. And then she said, she was like 10 or 15 minutes. And then she said very quietly, "This is very hard. You have to help me." Remarkable thing for a person to say. "This is very hard. You have to help me." And I don't have any way of knowing, because she wasn't explaining anything. That's all she said. But I think she was trying to get into the light. And she was just trying to find the light and get out of her body by going into the light. "This is very hard. You have to help me." And then the absolute last thing she said was, "God, Christ, Guru," like that. And then she didn't speak. And then about 5 or 10 minutes later, she stopped breathing. I mean, remarkable. Swamiji said afterwards, she was an extremely advanced soul. She said, you can't die like that without enormous advancement. Just extraordinary. But you can, and then there's the story of Ramana Maharshi's mother. Yes, it was his mother. But it was about his mother and also the death of a different disciple. When his mother died, I guess the details are not entirely important. I think this is how the story went. But when his mother died, she had come to stay with him, and then he was there with her when she died. And he stayed with her for quite a bit of time after she died, is what I recall. Or he wouldn't leave her. The point is simply this. He spoke about his mother's... He was very careful with his mother's death and very attentive for a long time. He never let down his guard, I think even for a while after she left her body. Because in contrast, he spoke about another disciple of his who he had helped move, into the light. But maybe he left too soon, and then something grabbed his consciousness and he was pulled back down again. And that's what I just reflect, that Paula, I think, was sort of working with that, with the energy pulling her one way. She'd had, and many of you know this about her, she used to be a clothes buyer for Mountain Song. She had a tremendous sense of fashion, beautiful relationship with clothes and scarves and hats, and she had closets and closets full of clothes. And she spiritualized it by running this beautiful store for Ananda. But she had a near-death experience years before she finally died of cancer. in which she overdosed on codeine cough syrup because she's very unsystematic, and she just kept sipping it. And she was in a hotel room by herself, and she had overdosed. And she just felt herself dying, really. And she, for some reason, she crawled into the bathroom because she thought if she could put water on her face, it would revive her. And she was sort of leaning on the toilet seat. And she started going down the tunnel of light. She just saw the whole thing come, and she felt herself rushing out of her body. The thought crossed her mind, oh, mother, am I going to die leaning over a toilet bowl? It was just like... But she said she was heading down the tunnel of light, and she remembered an outfit she had put on layaway that day at the clothing mart where she was. And the thought of that outfit pulled her back. It saved her life. I said, did you buy it? She said, no way. I'm never going to buy that. But it was like it was like a prelude. She experienced that you sort of, in other words, the tunnel of light is nothing but the spiritual eye. You're not actually physically moving. It's your consciousness is expanding into it. You know, you're moving from the medulla to the spiritual eye, and our consciousness was expanding to it. Then the ego remembered an event, and it identified with that event, and it was attached to that event. I mean, Paula overspent her income on clothes and had way too many clothes and so on, but she could still die so consciously, so it couldn't have been that much of a problem. But still, it was just that, what about this thing that I have done? And it just brought her right out of it and back into the medulla. Now, this is the essence of the spiritual path, is where is our consciousness located? And, you know, are we being compelled by our ego, or is our ego just a necessary part of the life that we have to live? Because we have to have a personality, we have to act through something, we have to act through a body. And that's how he writes at great length at the end of this chapter, I use the body like a carpenter uses his hammer in order to go places and do things and interact with people and have something that people can see. This is just what the masters do. I mean, think about master putting on a body. And he says, when I see the personality, I have to assume at first it feels like a heavy overcoat on a hot day, confining, uncomfortable, restricting, but then I get used to it. Now, just isn't that marvelous to contemplate? Because we're so committed, and so much of our happiness seems to depend on what we think of as ourself, instead of just thinking this is something I use. And then he goes on to say it, that the mind discriminates. Let's see, the mind perceives. How did he exactly say it? Let me just say it exactly right. I think. Oh, my awareness of what happens. That's how he put it. The mind is aware of what's happening. The intellect then discriminates over it. Because the mind just has the awareness to see that, oh, look, I'm in this room. And then the intellect begins to think, oh, and we're having a class, and some people are listening and some aren't, and what she's saying is not as interesting as what she said last week, or it's more interesting. You know, just all these different things, and, you know, she brought her telephone list instead of her notes, and all these different thoughts that we have. The mind just perceives what's going on. The intellect begins to discriminate about it. And then the senses report to us about everything that's happening. You know, she's wearing a blue dress, the air is a little fresh in here, it's nice to have a little elbow room, just all these different things. Oh, I'm glad they're not having incense or whatever. Now, the false understanding is to actually think that which is myself is the things that are happening instead of they're just happening around me. I don't know how, it's difficult to make vivid, so it's just a good thing to practice. I swim for exercise, and you know, you sort of move through that whole medium of water when you're swimming, and it's a whole different medium than just walking through the air, but you don't really think that you've become that medium. It's a different medium. You're just moving what you have through it, and it's easier to sort of feel a little bit outside of it because it's unusual. But think about just moving a body through this whole world and all the things that the body has to do in order to live in this world, including the mind being aware and the intellect thinking and the senses perceiving, as something that's going on but it isn't really me. It's just happening around me. This is the shifting. You see, when the consciousness is at the medulla, that's when we think we're doing it. Now, once we can grasp that, and God knows it's so hard to say in words and it's very hard to grasp, but then everything else naturally follows from it. Don't be disturbed, even by your failings, because your failings are just happening around you. They're not really you. Everything that happens is just, you're just moving through this medium of life, and you're always untouched. Swami talks about, at the very beginning of this, describing inner and outer action, how the jivan mukta, who may be deeply meditating, may in fact be reliving all his incarnations, you know, ridding himself of the karma of those incarnations by detaching himself from any personal identity with what happened. Now, we can think of that a little, because you can think about things you might have done, in, even in this life, that you would just never do again, either positive or negative. You would just never do again. I heard someone speaking, just overheard the comment, I was a vegetarian for 10 years, you know, and every so often you just get a bloodlust and you have to eat something, you know, meat. And it was just like a comment. And I thought, I've been a vegetarian for 40 years and that's never occurred to me. You know, it's just like, I didn't have to discipline myself to do it. It's what it says there. You renounce when it's not hard for you. You know, I just stopped eating meat because I couldn't stand it. I just didn't like it. There was no issue about making myself do it. But my sister's comment, I can't hardly remember my childhood because I was just waiting to meet Swami until I did. Her comment when she heard I became a vegetarian was, if she can be a vegetarian, anybody could be. I said, was I like really fond of meat? You know, I just never thought about it. But that was her thought. And I can picture myself going into the refrigerator and pulling out the turkey carcass and the cold roast beef and just all those things. But I couldn't even imagine it now. You know, it happened. It happened and I that which I call I, was present. But it could have happened to someone else. Now, but just think, why is it that the things that we're doing now are any more us than things that we can look at like that and think that it's just not who I am anymore? Even moment to moment, we're not the same person. It's an interesting fact. Swamiji made the comment once. He said, if you must judge yourself, evaluate yourself is what he meant by that. He said, which I don't advise. He said, the only accurate evaluation of yourself is what you aspire to become. Because anything that you can look at and name, by definition, is already behind you. You see? Because time passes, and that's the whole Bhagavad Gita is in the past tense. You can't reflect on it till it's behind you. And then you can learn from it, but you're simply not that anymore. It's gone. And if the degree to which we can just see our whole life is just flowing, it's not an abdication of responsibility. It's assuming responsibility on a much deeper level, because it's learning. It's the same way the man picks up the hammer and he pounds and he realizes, well, that, you know, that technique didn't work. This technique works better. That technique works better. This works better. You learn from it. You see, oh, I'm using this body. That didn't quite work right. I'm using this discrimination. I didn't really use it properly. I'm using the will and the senses. I didn't really quite use it right. But it's just a tool. This whole ego is just a tool for self-realization. It's not us. And if we don't use it well, let's learn to use it well. But even if it becomes grand and glorious, what does that have to do with us? That's why, you know, someone like Swamiji, at the beginning, I mean, people understand him better now, but people used to think at times he was egoic because he was actually so indifferent. He would say things like, let me tell you all the things that we accomplished, that I accomplished this last year, and then I wrote this book and this book, and this book was so good, and that music was so beautiful. And people would hear that and think, you know, what is he talking about? But to him, they were just things that happened that he was excited about. I've had that relationship my whole life to cooking, partly because the way I was raised, it wasn't a skill that was particularly valued. The values in my family were all intellectual, and cooking just wasn't in the running. Plus, I learned to cook by the grace of Swami, who just sort of opened this intuition for me to be able to cook. So it's always been kind of a miracle to me. So I have a tendency to say, oh, the soup is so good, you will love it. You know, and I'll put it on the table. And it's only later that occurs to me, it could sound a little self-important. But I'm using that as a small example because all of us have areas in our life in which we're very detached. You know, we just do something, we're very detached from it. Where is the limit to that? If we can be that way about anything that happens through us, why would we not be that way about everything that happens through us? And most challenging of all, of the difficult things that happen, of the times when we use our tool really, really stupidly. But it doesn't define us any more than the successors do. It was just a bad use of the tool. Isn't it an interesting way to look about it? And you know, what we can do from this is we can just start living like this, just on an everyday basis. It's a spiritual practice that you can have so much fun with. You're out there hanging the laundry on the line, you're driving your car down the street, you're going into Starbucks to order a latte. You know, just move from the medulla, move to the spiritual eye, watch your body buy the latte, watch your body enjoy the latte, watch your senses taste it, watch your body converse with others, you know, not in a way that makes you certifiably nuts or even peculiar, but this is the way the masters live in the world. That's why when you look into master's eyes, and Swamiji would talk about that, when master was there, he said he'd look into master's eyes, and there was no one there. He was living through that, but he wasn't defined by it on any level. That's what you see in Swamiji's eyes so much of the time now. All this summer, wherever he was, there was just this same just look in his eyes that essentially told you that this, you know, this was this little slit through which this enormous force was flowing, but his relationship with Kriyananda had just dissolved, in essence. Isn't it a fun practice? I mean, all day long today I've been sort of playing with this. You know, you pick up a spoon, you're eating like this, and just thinking completely in another reality. And this is how, even though it's outer work, it becomes inner work at all times. I've been reading this book years ago, just before David and I came here in 1987. We knew that we were coming in July of 86. We came in January of 87. July of 86, Swamiji asked us to take this responsibility. We had 6 months before we moved because it was our first trip to India, our first India pilgrimage. So we had to do that. And then after the pilgrimage, we knew that once we got here, we were going to be chained to the spot for a really long time. So we took about a three-week holiday through Europe. And we took what turned out to be largely a Divine Mother pilgrimage. We went to Lourdes and Fatima and where Teresa of Avila lived and to where Therese Nuiman lived. What's the name of that? Where is that she lives? Connorsreuth, which is just out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It must have been even more nowhere when she was there. It was so strange. This is an offshoot, but just so strange to contemplate where she chose to incarnate in just this, you know, this, it's way up in Germany, right up near the border of what used to be Czechoslovakia. It's just way out there. Germany is totally organized. Every single intersection in Germany is marked both directions, clearly, with a consistent sign. So even though you're just way out in the middle of nowhere, it's still absolutely organized. But we were way out there, and it's just this huge farming community, even now, just this farming community. This great soul just dropped herself in the middle of nowhere and just served from that environment. Partly it saved her life, probably because of she had to live through Hitler and all of that. But this isn't about her. It's about Fatima. We went to Fatima in Portugal, where Mother Mary appeared to three shepherds, two girls and a boy, brother and sister, and then Lucia, who was the oldest one of the three, who must have been 10 or 12, and the others were 6 or 8. Both Francesco and Jacinta, who are the little ones, both died as children. And Lucia lived until the 1990s, I think. She lived quite to a ripe old age in a convent. And there's this book that she wrote, Fatima, in her own words. And it's under obedience. Lucia had to write all these different things. It's all a very long introduction for something that's extremely interesting. She talked about, just from what she describes in there, and let me sort of say this correctly. These three little children were just out with their sheep, and first an angel came to them, and then this beautiful woman came to them, and they had visions of Jesus. And then every month for 6 or 8 months, on a certain day, there would be this vision, and gradually this huge, enormous, force of devotion built up around these three little children. And there were all the usual controversy of the people thinking that it was a scam and those who thought it was true. And the children had to endure a great deal of ridicule and persecution and attempts to make them confess that it was just fraud and all of that. And Lucia writes, even from childhood and even now at this age, partly she lives under exactly the kind of monastic obedience that Swami speaks not so highly of here. But Lucia's entirely surrendered to the inner voice of what God wants of her without any interfering anxieties or thoughts of her own. If this is what's asked of me, this is what I'll do. And it's not that she doesn't suffer, but you can see the way she describes it now as an old nun and even as a child, there was always this separation. There was the anxiety of persecution and all these people looking at her and not knowing what was going to be coming of her and her family being upset with her. And then on the other hand, there was this absolute surrender to just doing whatever it was that the vision had told her to do, that she began to understand was, the Immaculate Heart of Mary, is how she was always saying it, that Mary wanted her to do. And her sense of self was so deeply rooted in her experience of Mary that everything else that happened, no matter what it was, could never touch the reality of that vision. And whatever was asked of her, she would face with this tremendous confidence that Mary would tell her what to do, and then she would just do what Mary wanted, and that was all there was to it. And there was so much just beautiful freedom in that. And it was that the whole life she was living, and it's partly because of her particular theology, but theology in this was very, very powerful because she's going to die and go to heaven. That's what going to happen at the end of this. And it was so interesting because the two little children who did die were told by Mary right away that their lives were going to be short, they weren't going to live very long, they were going to get sick, and they were going to die, and they were going to go to heaven and be with Mary and Jesus. And they were just so happy about that. They were just so happy. And poor Lucia wasn't going to get to die. She was going to have to stay a really long time, and it would be a really long time before she got to heaven. And it's not a theology that we follow exactly, but nonetheless, the essential freedom that theology presented is really beautiful to contemplate, which is the end of this whole story, is that we're just going to merge into the infinite. And all we really have to do is just keep loyal to that ideal. It doesn't mean we never stumble, fall, make mistakes, slip from it. This is where Swamiji said, do not see yourself in terms of what you do. See yourself only in terms of what you aspire to do. Because that aspiration really defines you. Because it doesn't really matter how often you slip and fall. Because if you aspire to succeed, you will. Swami would say often, a slip is not a fall. Merely to stumble on the path where you're going, as long as you stay on the path, sooner or later you will succeed. And it's that identifying ourselves with our aspiration and our ultimate achievement of that aspiration instead of this body and even this ego that we're merely using to sort of transit the time and transit the levels of consciousness till we reach that. Isn't that fascinating? Okay, let's take a break. Do we have any questions? Wait just a second, wait till we get going again. Okay, James, what do you have to say?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what I'm describing either. The question is... Okay, the references, the question has to do with when you leave your body in death, and I was quoting Paul as saying this is so difficult, and Ramana Maharshi about how he helped his disciple get free and then something pulled him back. Well, Paul is an example of you're just merging into the light. It's absolutely blissful. And then thoughts will enter your mind like, oh, but this light is much too fine for me. I'm not worthy of receiving this light. You know, I've never really been such a good devotee. I can't really go into this. Or the thought will come and you'll be merging into the light and you think, well, but who will take care of my baby? Or my mother will be so disappointed. Or you'll think of a resentment of, oh, I'm merging into this light, you know, and Tommy's not coming with me, the creep, you know. Just all the different identifications that we have. I mean, just think about it. I observe this in the transitions between subconsciousness and consciousness, either in falling asleep or in waking up. You'll wake up and you'll start to absorb a certain reality. And then bits and pieces of other things will come into it, or you'll start to fall asleep in a very harmonious way and you'll begin to relax, and then some buried anxiety will come to the surface. Oh dear, I forgot about dealing with so-and-so, or just this sense of nervousness about something that you'll realize is attached to this or that, because you're beginning to, your conscious mind is losing its grip. So you start going into that light and all of the vrittis in your chakras will start responding to the upward flow of energy, and whatever vrittis you have, whatever vortices of ego-based attachment that you have will rise to the surface and try to dominate what's happening. You're trying to let them go and they're trying to hold on to you.
But it then limits as far as you can go.
Yes, exactly. It limits whether or not you're going to become liberated or not. Because in order to become liberated, there must be nothing that holds you. And it liberates also the vibration with which you will die. I mean, it's not just a question. I mean, I've said it in terms of going out through the spiritual eye or falling back to the ego. I don't actually know how to explain. I don't know what it is. Because what it is you go out with the consciousness, you know, as elevated a consciousness as you have, you go out with the consciousness that you have. But if you have lived your life in a holy and divine way and have done your best to be detached and have thought often about the spiritual eye and have meditated deeply, naturally you can go much farther into that before the limits of your freedom will assert themselves. Does that make sense to you? No, it's not frightening because it's mathematical. It's not frightening in the sense that...
You frighten yourself to a lower potential.
No, because there's nothing unfair about what happens. That's what I was saying. It's perfectly mathematical. It's the vrittis in your chakras will interact with the aspiration of your soul and you'll end up bingo right where you need to be. And that's where all dogma, all theory, all mind stuff means nothing. You'll just happen exactly as you're supposed to happen. But we should practice, you know, the fact we should practice liberating ourselves from all attachments, because the moment of death is a wonderful opportunity. It's the final exam. And you can transcend yourself if you've got everything in place to do a good job. And if you've been very cavalier about your attachments, they'll just eat you up and you get to do the whole story over again. That's why, there's a few thoughts, let me try to reach them in there. That's why Swamiji speaks very strongly against organ donation, because in order for the organs to be harvested in a useful state, there must be sufficient life force still in them. And if there's sufficient life force still in them, that means that you haven't really moved that far away from it. And even more than that, it's not that you're being cut up while you're still alive, but it's that in those moments, even if you have moved outside your body and so it's now dead, your relationship to it is still unclear, because you're outside of it, and you, in the first few minutes of being outside of it, you may not be entirely comfortable with being outside of it. And it's not a time when you want people to come rushing in and start hacking the body to pieces, because it can cause you to panic, or at least become concerned about that which you've been so accustomed to being part of, that you don't want anything to mix you up at that moment. So even though it's considered to be a very generous thing, spiritually speaking, Swamiji is very strong against it, because that moment of transition is extremely important. And you want to be able to just move away from that body without interference. That's why they often say you should leave the body for, you know, at least an hour or some time. Don't mess with it, so that the soul can not become confused, but just keep moving away from the body without becoming panicky about what's happening to it. Does that make sense? But there's nothing to be scared of. I think it's just something to be gleefully looked forward to. But just bearing in mind, in a very simple way, we are what we are. You can't make... I mean, when we first started, meaning the group of friends I had when I was 19 years old, when we first started learning about these spiritual truths, and one of my friends, who was kind of a humorous fellow, but a little bit of a how bad can I be and still get away with it kind of guy, he thought, when he heard that sound is the last sense to go, and that you want to go out hearing the sound of the Om, he thought that he would just put headphones on, and you know, then he would just listen to the Om, and then he would merge into the Om, and that would overtake everything else. In fact, it wasn't false. They tell you to chant Om into the right ear of a dying person, and several times when I've been present when people are dying, we've played Swami's tape of chanting the Om. It's just ideal, and it is just the right thing. But you can't cheat. You can't live a worldly life and then make yourself spiritual at the end, because your mind will just go there. Master tells that story of the dying man who was still arguing with his son because he was wasting oil by turning the lamp wick up too high. You know, just even his body was dying. He was almost done, and he was still thinking about all those sorts of things. That's the level at which we're thinking about this. That's why when Paula died, there was a moment, part of the way we really knew it was over is her husband. She had a husband that she'd only been married to a few years, and they were very devoted. She was very fond of him, and he'd been with her in a very close way through all these days. And when she sat up at the very end for that last half hour or so, he sat down on the bed next to her, as he'd often done. He put his arm around her. I don't know if she actually moved his arm off, but she moved. She said, "Don't touch me, I can still feel it." Just like there was no relationship with him anymore. It was just over, just like it's done. So what was the point of that? I've always thought, you know, it's like you see old people and you think it's so important. You surround them with pictures of their families and all their children, and it's just, I think, why? When you get to the end of your life, take all those pictures down. You don't want to be identified with all that those limited things. And it's very, oftentimes people won't die when their loved ones are in the room. They'll just wait till the 1 minute when they're left alone, because it's too hard. All their energy is pulling and they can't turn their mind in another direction. And so it's important to be impersonal even with the ones that you love, and recognize we're just moving through this in this way. Yes, Ramani? Well, it was so interesting. This was Swami Shivananda, and this was movies of his body after he died. You know, there's movies like that of Sri Yukteswar. It's so frustrating that we don't have them. So, and then there's this Shivananda, and then his body is empty. And his head is turned up like this, and his mouth is somewhat open like that. Like the pictures of Sri Yukteswar, looks just the same. And they wash the body, and then they put it on a litter, and they cover it with flowers, and it's just, they're carrying it all over the place, and it just was so it was just so thrilling somehow. He'd lived, he'd used it, and this was the shell that was left, and his soul was gone, and now they were going to take it to the Ganges or whatever they did with it. No, they buried it, of course. They buried it in the ashram and put a temple over it. But it was just so fun to just see the body just going around like that, and everybody all crowded around, touching it and getting the blessing of it. And what a marvelous thing. Death to me has always been such an interesting story. I love to talk about death. I love to talk about attunement, and I love to talk about dying. Dying is just so terrific because it is the final exam of the whole experience. And it seems to me so intensely and absolutely relevant at every single moment. Because all we're ever doing is just getting ready to give it all up. So are we going to give it up because it's wrenched from our hands and then we're just going to hang out in the astral world hoping desperately that it'll come back again? Or are we going to live all the time with this perfect freedom? That's why the whole story of Christianity is about the avatar giving up his life, his body in death. And of course, resurrecting. But also just saying, there's the wacky story about Neem Karoli Baba when Richard Alpert, as he was known then, who was so into the consciousness-changing drugs, you know, he just took so much LSD and everything like that. And then he went to India and met this guru who is an odd man. He's a very eccentric guru. And either Richard Alpert gave it to him or he asked for it, but he took a huge handful of LSD pills, you know, enough to kick any normal person into some extremely odd, chemically induced psychotic state. He just gobbled them up, zero. It had zero effect on him. It just did nothing to him. And it was just like this was what this man was so into, and he was so influenced, Richard Alpert, so influenced by all these things. And this guru just showed, I don't have anything to do with this plane of consciousness. I just use this body. This body does not use me. Swami talked about this Swami Narayan that he met in Delhi in 1972, I think is when he met him. He was a very well-known and very well-respected Swami. He's passed away now. He was so powerful. And Swami, he was reputed, again, to have this tremendous ability. And at some point, somebody challenged him with drinking, and he drank quarts and quarts of whiskey. Had no effect on his consciousness, just none. Swamiji said he drank so much whiskey, a person could hardly drink that much water. But it just had no effect on him. Because he used the body didn't use him. What was happening to the body did not define his state of awareness. And that's why you just come back to whole other realities. The spiritual path is not the same as the psychological path. It's very, very different. We're just doing something completely else. We're not trying to have nice egos that work really well. We're just trying to kick them aside completely. And that's why you see in India where this is so well understood, especially among true saints. I was talking about this on a Sunday a few weeks ago after we'd watched some of the films that Swami Bodhichidananda brought us of some real saints in India. They were just so wacky, you know, so indifferent to their appearance, so unconcerned with all the little niceties that everybody's so concerned with. And so many aspects of India, it's changing, it's becoming more Western, it's probably better. But so much of it, they're just so indifferent. So many of the scenes there with the saints, it was just, you know, you just sit at a table, you have a little plastic plate, you sit in some funky little chair, you're not wearing any shoes, you've just got a little cloth thrown around you. I mean, what is the point of all this worshiping of this, which is just going to go into ashes sooner or later? Now, that's the kind of mental detachment we have to have. Now, Master, that was not our path, but to be mentally detached from it, what difference does it make? I'm just using this. And if I have to live in a house, I'm going to live in a nice one. It's appropriate. If I'm going to be in a body, Swami himself had to teach me to dress nicely. You should have respect for yourself and for the people who have to look at you. But indifference to it at the same time. When it passes, who knows? There's one more thing I really want to talk about because it was so fascinating in here. When Swami starts talking about how the body withdraws, the soul withdraws, and the nadis and the Brahma nadi, and I can't add anything to any of that because these are not things that I know. But the part that strikes me here, he says the nerves are the passages for life force in the body, and they're the physical manifestation of the subtle nadis, they call it, of the astral body. So the astral body is the blueprint, and then it manifests from that blueprint into physical form. And so the nerve channels are where the subtle energy would be in the astral body is where they are. And then he talks about how these nerve passages is such a simple statement about how to live. The nerve channels become clogged. They become clogged with the toxins of wrong diet, he said. And then because we're so often looking outward for our stimulation, Swami doesn't mention here what Master called sex washouts. People who are so over-sexual in their interest that they just drain all their energy out looking for that kind of external stimulation. Or just that we live always to be fed from the outside with entertainment and stimulation and noise and food and all of these different things, that our energy gradually, that the nerves just become drained and they can't renew. And we just become tired all the time. If we live habitually from the inner source and we draw our energy more from the inner source, this is why Master created the energization exercises. Specifically, so that we can revitalize ourselves from the eternal source and not always just be thinking about what we get from the outside. Because when these nerve channels are clogged and exhausted, the way he said it, it's an outward flow of energy becomes habitual and it resists the meditative efforts. And then you have to purify the nerves, is how they put it, by right diet, by yoga asanas, by the practice of meditation, of course, of Kriya. But then, this is the part that got interesting to me. He then lists out all these spiritual practices, asanas, mudras, pranayams, devotional chanting, prayer. And about prayer and chanting specifically is where the thought was really keyed. He said, the mere use of the voice in devotional chanting lifts the energy. And prayer, he said, apart from appealing to God for an answer, he said, helps to focus one's own thoughts and feelings. And this picture just sort of came into my mind. I thought of so many things that these great souls tell us. You can literally meditate on them for a lifetime, and then only slowly do you begin to understand. There's two stories in my book that I myself wrote that I just understood more deeply from here, where a woman wrote to Swamiji and said that she was facing a very difficult crossroad in her life, and the decision she made would have great implication for a long time. And she had prayed and prayed and prayed about which of the two choices she should make, and she simply couldn't get an answer. Swami wrote back, "It doesn't matter. Take either choice," he said. "Master is pleased simply that you've asked." Now, what I'm understanding here is the entire spiritual path is inner transformation. And if we habitually pray, which is to lift our consciousness up and say, "Master, what would you like me to do?" What we're actually doing, you see, is we're constantly shifting our attention from the medulla to the spiritual eye. We're constantly drawing our energy from the inside instead of allowing ourselves to be influenced only from the outside. We're setting our aspiration to be in tune with the spirit, which purifies both our consciousness and our nervous system so that making one fully receptive to divine inspiration. So the act of doing it is an end in itself, you see? It doesn't really matter. Once we've devoted ourselves to trying to do God's will, that was God's will. It wasn't anything else. It was just trying to guide our lives in that direction. And so all of those actions, which we tend to see as external, the purpose of them is not really external. The purpose of them is that by constantly drawing from the inner energy and lifting our energy upward, we purify our inner nature. We dissolve those vrittis because our commitment has become toward living from that vibration and not from the ego's vibration. So the mere effort is all that's required, is the goal. And once again, it all leads back to, why do we ever worry about anything? You know, why do we become concerned about how all the little ups and downs manifest if we look merely and only to our own inner intentions? That's why this, another phrase of Swamiji's that was from Master, God reads the heart. Which just means work on your inner aspiration, the purity of your intention. Whether things work out or not, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Whether some bit of bad karma, even on your part, messes up what you intended, it doesn't matter. God reads the heart. And, you know, I always talk about Paula so often. Paula had to go bankrupt toward the end of her life because she just didn't really have the knack of managing her money. She tended to overspend and she just wasn't always practical. But she died with Master's, you know, presence so powerful that it was one of the most extraordinary experiences any of us had ever been through. And it's just like her desire was to live for God. Certain talents were developed, certain talents weren't. What difference does it make? Nothing matters. Even prayer, chanting, meditation is just to smooth out those nerve channels and lift our consciousness upward. Take care of the inner reality and nothing else matters. Isn't that wonderful? It's all right here in the Bhagavad Gita. Okay? That'll finish us for tonight. All right?